But along the way, you're constantly designing, dissolving the current problems that you have, but interacting and engaging with entirely new emergent problems that couldn't even be described or explained or anticipated or even imagined in the older systems.
Greetings and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war. I'm Major Josh Bedingfield, here alongside Majors Kelsey Kurtz and Dan Warner. We'll be your hosts today. We continue our discussion on center of gravity analysis and its application across the range of military operations, with special emphasis on how the space domain further complicates our current understanding of the theory. If you have not yet listened to part one, we encourage listeners to check out our last episode. Thanks for joining us.
You know, you had me thinking you are coming at this with a different perspective, dealing with space, you know, as part of the operational environment. And there, the effects are neutral, more so on ground, because they're not constrained by the same laws of physics. And I think it's really interesting that you've taken this space-based physics approach to war. But does that shape how you guys talk about effects? I really am seeing the linkage between the rhizome with the tree and a effects neutral operating environment that can bend physics laws, if that makes sense.
All right, so I got to remind the audience here, this is Ben Zweibelson, the civilian academic, spouting his own opinion.
Absolutely. And I'm taking, we don't have a lot of space experts or space adjacent experts here. So I am curious if you can speak to your operating environment and how that might differ from a earthbound tactical perspective.
So that's a marvelous question. I am not a space expert, but I dabble in space. So what I would offer is, okay, let's take the center of gravity one of the reasons why it's very popular is because, once again, we have a Newtonian style worldview. That's our warframe. It's based in a Westphalian, Clausewitzian, Napoleonic, Baconian, Newtonian. I know there's all those words, right? But they're all thinkers and theories from around the same time, and they all fuse together in Europe to generate what we're using today as the juggernaut. Because Western society, whether you like it or not, has been the economic and the military and the diplomatic and the political and the informational juggernaut of the last several centuries, even though it's passed from country to country. And so the juggernaut of Europe is doing these things predominantly in sea and land, right? So you have continental and you have maritime strategies, right? And then only recently did we really start getting to the air domain. So you go from Corbett and Mahan into Dohet, and then of course we have Clausewitz and Jomini and Vauban and others. But then you go into the 20th century where we're suddenly going into, we have new domains, space. Right? Space is a weird domain. And cyberspace, which is it's a artificially constructed domain that's connected to physical domains. Right? And that's strange because you can physically point out where the servers are. You can physically map how long a signal takes to go from, say, a satellite or over cables. But when you are interacting in cyberspace, your mind, right? When you look at your smartphone, your Twitter app may be right next to your Facebook app. And you might even push a button inside of Facebook so that it shares it to Twitter or LinkedIn. But these things don't work in geography the way that the physical domains operate. And cyber people will go in much greater detail as they're experts on this. But cyberspace itself has no space. The space is where we stretch what cyber doesn't have space into where it's manifesting in the physical domains. And that's what maintains cyberspace. You have to have the servers and whatever, so that you can have a cyberspace. But inside of cyberspace, there is no space. There's information and time and speed, right? And so space, let's go into the space domain, right? It's as our deputy commander, General Shaw, has coined the phrase earlier, super global. And so this isn't like land, air, or sea, but we project things like cogs and concepts into the space domain. But one of the big distinctions between land and sea over the last multiple centuries, and you can find it in Clausewitz, you can find it in Jomini, you can find it in maritime theory by Corbett or Mahan, is that continental strategy is sequential. And what I mean by that is, look at how we do our lines of effort to get to the critical vulnerability of the enemy's operational and strategic cog while protecting our own. We do a series of phases of operations and activities that are linked together in a linear way, branches and sequels as well. But it's sequential in that you take and seize territory, and then you outmaneuver or you position your forces so that you either fight or strike the enemy or you achieve other terrains. But it's a series of sequential activities that has to, particularly in Clausewitz, but also in many other theorists, has to result in the destruction of the enemy's force so that you can then break down the will of the people. That's Clausewitz's addition. Jomini was all about destroying the army. And that's not Eastern at all. That's purely Western. Eastern philosophy going back thousands of years is entirely different on warfare. So when you see doctrine writers put Sun Tzu in the same chapter as Clausewitz, that's just advocating how ignorant we are of our own history and our own theory. But it makes for good doctrine, which is good for bonfires. So maritime strategy, maritime warfare, is not sequential because you can't park a battleship over a piece of terrain. And I know I'm stretching things here, but basically Mahan and Corbett both agree that it's a cumulative effort. And by cumulative, I mean you have to destroy as much as possible of the sea power, or later Dohet would argue and extend it to the air power, because you needed to control that domain. And you could, in both in air and sea, the theorists would say, you could have a couple of airplanes or a couple of ships still going around, but if you control the sea against your adversary, that's what you need to be able to do. So it's about smashing and destroying as much of the infrastructure and capability of force that the enemy has in those domains, so that you can then maximize your control and superiority of it, right? So that's where you got air and sea superiority. But remember, the big distinction here is continental is sequential, right? And air and sea are cumulative. Now, here's the problem with the space domain. And we're going to tie this back into Cox, right? The space domain has both, because satellites move on orbits. So that if you destroy a satellite, or if you don't, there's nothing like that in the air, sea, or land, in that if you sink a battleship, it goes to the bottom of the sea. If I blow up a tank, it stays there. Or if Kim Jong-un shoots persistent chem into a mountain pass, it stays there and we don't go near it, right? So those continental things don't move. If you shoot an airplane out of the sky, it falls. You blow a satellite up in orbit, in low Earth orbit, it stays there. And potentially, depending on how you destroy it, it's going to create even more catastrophic damage and impact other things. A satellite that attacks another satellite that's in close orbit to it may then become victim, unless you can use Delta V to get out of there, may become victim to the very debris that it just created and the next time around the orbit. And if you're low Earth orbit, you know, that's about 90 minutes. And this is fascinating stuff. So there's the element of sequential, right? So in sequential with the space domain, can you deny your adversary access to launch? There's certain parts of the world that are much better, because the Earth actually isn't round, it's flat. No, I'm just kidding. The Earth is shaped as a spheroid, but it's fat in the middle. And because of gravity, science, it's easier for you to launch rockets closer to the equator. It's much harder the closer you get to the poles. So in terms of sequential, if you can control the maximum launch areas, you're in a great position. If you can control orbits, particular key orbits, that's great. That could be sequential as well. If you can control these things called Lagrange points, which are empty spots in space, but guess what? They have these like almost magical, but not really because it's science. They have these scientific properties that in between two large celestial objects, you can put something there and it stays there. Doesn't move, right? And so they have enormous strategic requirements and potential there, right? So you can have a sequential. You can have sequential stuff all throughout the space domain. But then there's the cumulative. Because when we go hot in some sort of simulated orbital warfare, it's all about trying to knock out enough of the enemy's capabilities, whether you're doing it reversible or non-reversible, and maintaining what you have so that you can still use the space domain. So you're not going to find that type of strange paradox in air, land, or sea as you do in the space domain, which begs the question of, okay, why are we going to apply centers of gravity into how we look at space domain warfare? Well, you have to. Why? because doctrine says so.
You bring up a really good point that I've been struggling with this last couple of weeks, is like winning, setting conditions and winning in phase zero and phase one, and where operational planners, where do we win, right? Like we're super focused right now on the division tactical fight, right? Left flank, right flank, penetrating, all this fun stuff. But you could potentially set the conditions to achieve success well before conflict happens. And like, if you're doing it right, you know, like Sun Tzu says, you know, war never happens, you just win, right? Without going to conflict. So are we maybe using these models also in the wrong context? How we understand how the world evolves or how conflict arises? And if yes or no, is there anything that we're doing right that we can transfer to a new model or theory?
Well, that's an easy question, Dan. Jeez. Well, this is a Sam's podcast, so we're diving in. That's an oral comp question that would make somebody probably screaming around the room. But let's dive into it, shall we? First, you said phases. Well, to quote Dr. Evil, I don't do phases. What I would offer, though, is that when we look at how we do operational planning, how we form our strategies, we are entirely, and I say we, the Western world, we are entirely based not just in a Newtonian style, because that came only in the last couple of centuries. That came with the rise of natural science, right? So you got to go before, really, even Machiavelli. You got to go before Vauban. You got to go into ancient Greek history. And so when we're in the natural philosophy part of ancient Greece, there was two different schools. And so you had one school. I'm probably going to say his name wrong. I'm terrible with my Greek, Herodicus. And Herodicus said, you can't step in the same river twice, which has been misattributed to Sun Tzu, right? But really, you had some really, really old Greek thinkers that were looking at this stuff that way. But they got strangled out by Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, and this school of, we're going to do tree form, centralized hierarchies. The man is equal to the state. The state is structured in a hierarchy, and this is how it goes. Now, that also happened in China around the same period. You had Taoism, which still is very important, but you had a competing school of Confucianism. And Confucianism was doing what the ancient Greeks were doing, which is you have to have a centralized hierarchy that's centered around the emperor. You have to have these triangle type shapes. So both East and West do these two types of things. But in the Greek side, we got rid of what was our Greek Taoism, if you will. We just snuffed it out. And this goes into why we do phases. It's also why we reverse engineer. And it's also how we look at winning, right? So we tend to establish a predetermined goal that we imagine for the future, and the future goal is different than what we are now. Otherwise, you're not planning, you're just breathing, right? And this goal now has to be heroically acted upon by you, whoever you are, generally your military leader or decision maker. And it's through heroic action of everyone, I am about to do these things, and I'm going to arrange them in this sequence, and I'm going to achieve this desired future. So that's ends, ways, and means. This is the philosophical underpinning of everything that we do, to include what brought about our scientific revolution, right? But science goes in a different way upon that, and that's a slightly different nuanced discussion. But let me jump forward to complexity theory and why we don't do it in the military and why it's missing from doctrine. We steal the words, but we don't take any of the theory with us, right? We use different dictionaries for when we talk about complexity, emergence, nonlinearity. So Russell Aikoff has an incredible short article that should be in every PME program. And in this very brief article, he talks about the four different ways he argues that all human beings approach problems. He says there's problem solution, there's problem absolution, there's problem resolution, and then there's problem dissolution. So let's start with problem absolution. That's where you ignore the problem and hope it goes away. Now, the military doesn't do that, does it?
It's a trap again, and I refuse to be Admiral Ackbar.
He should have took out that Star Destroyer.
No, I mean, I am not going to drive the conversation into how COG is a really excellent way to view an analysis on the first or second battle of the Death Star as a contained system where we can have a really good intellectual conversation of it. But nonetheless, no Admiral Ackbar.
I'm thinking more Mad Max, that's bait.
So really, we do this a lot. So we do absolve things all the time. That's just part of society. I mean, it's part of the news cycle. It's part of how politics works. You just wait. You drop bad news on Friday afternoon at the Pentagon, and then everyone goes home, and you're like, it's Monday morning. Something else happened, right? So that's in our kit bag, and we do it. But the second one Acuff talks about is one that the military obsesses over so much that it doesn't consider anything else. Everywhere you see the word problem, you can do a word search in every single piece of doctrine that we have. Every single one. You're going to see problem, and in that sentence or the related sentence, you're going to find solution. Even when we say that it's a complex system and complexity can't necessarily be solved, we then say we're going to give the commander superior understanding so that he can appreciate complexity and solve the problem, right? Now, problem solution, according to Acuff, is that you can do this in simple and sometimes complicated systems. Simple systems, you're going to be able to solve them because there's only one solution, and that's where you optimize. So that's where you can have best practices. But complicated systems only have good enough solutions, but you're still able to solve the problem. Now, the other two, one is problem resolution. So those of you that are on the ground, particularly PSYOPs, civil affairs, special operations, infantry, combat arms, they would have to go and do these incredible missions in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And also going all the way back in history. And a lot of times you're with that village leader and there's something heinously corrupt going on and you just got to make something happen. And some things get in the report and some things just don't go in the report. They go in your book later, especially if you're a retired Navy SEAL. So problem resolution is you're making everyone mostly happy, but not everyone really happy. It's sort of like you have the drunk uncle that's coming to Thanksgiving and he's coming because he's family. So you're going to try to mitigate what happens. That's problem resolution. And the military does it a lot too. It's just not really in our doctrine. The last one though, this is the key. This is the important one that's not at all in it. And if we were going to add anything into the next version of JP50, and I'd still burn it, but you'd want to add Acuff's problem dissolution. And what he's saying there is that designers, and this is what design does different than planning, which is your last question. Designers will look at what we say a problem is today in the current system, and they will then enact, experiment, improvise, and create with failure iteratively so that the system, if you are able to achieve an act of innovation, or if you're on the receiving end, I guess, that the system changes in such a way that now you have dissolution of what the problem used to be. And a great example of that, in New York City, in the mid to late 1800s, they had an enormous problem of horse manure all over their streets. The automobile was what changed that system. And the problem of horse poopies dissolved. But think about all the new problems that New York City got with the introduction of automobiles, right? And so the thing about problem dissolution, this goes back to your comment on victory and winning, is that in complex systems, you don't win. In complex systems, you don't have victory or success. All of those are just bumper stickers we use for our ideology, right? In complex systems, it's about surviving and thriving and being able to maximize or gain in some sort of advantage. But along the way, you're constantly designing, dissolving the current problems that you have, but in interacting and engaging with entirely new emergent problems that couldn't even be described or explained or anticipated or even imagined in the older systems. And then part of this then becomes, all right, well, if we can't win and we can't have victory, then what are we doing? What are we doing, right? One of our challenges is that we look at it through a Western lens. We want a beginning, a middle, and an end. We want to have ends, ways, and means, and we want to have a goal or finish line. If you go into Eastern philosophy, and this is nuanced because you've got to go back into Sun Tzu, Lao Tzu, all the early Taoists, a lot of this stuff still exists today in current Chinese strategic thinking. We just don't pay homage to it mostly because we project upon it our own Clausewitzian, Napoleonic center of gravity constructs. And to their credit, the Chinese have adapted COGS too because, hey, we use them. They might as well use them. But they don't really use them at the philosophical level of war, or I would argue their strategy. Some of it is actually drawing from Taoism or Confucianism. The Taoism part is where you talk about that stuff upstream, that the Sage, who is could be a military general, the Sage is able to manipulate and do things before they become crises. And so Eastern philosophy would say dissolution, but it's occurring in the system before anyone really notices something is happening. And the side effect of that is you don't get your Greek hero. You don't get your statues in the street, right? Which begs the question, and somebody asked me on Twitter, well, wait a minute, give me an example of a great military heroic leader who did this Taoist Chinese stuff. And I offered, what about Gandhi? Gandhi's not a military leader. No, he's not, right? Because he didn't have to fight. He didn't fight a war. But he still achieved an incredible transformation and throw off the shackles of colonialism for his people. When you look at, and that's an example in modern war and peace studies of civil defense, not civil resistance, but civil defense. So the Danes did this in World War II against the Nazis. There were pockets of violent saboteurs, but the Danish society actually were poo-pooing them and saying, hey, that's not really us. That's not what we do. So they did this peaceful, passive resistance, right? So those are things where you can't have a hero because you don't have a climactic battle because it wasn't using Greek logic. Now, the Danes were still tied in a European system, but it's an interesting metaphor to show on that. So I'm going to...
I think I want to keep pulling on this string here, and I'll lead, I think, to some of the other follow-up topics we wanted to talk about. So what we're talking about now is getting into how design and systems thinking can help military planners or how it can be useful for the military. So just hear my maybe novel, not so novel idea that I had in a fever dream. So I was reading, I think it was Baerchin, Clausewitz and Nonlinearity. I'm sitting there and I'm going, all right, if you take Raji Daji's iterative process for inquiry, and you know, like context, function, structure, process. Maybe we didn't see that. Like, I almost think of center of gravity and our understanding of Clausewitz is we did Napoleon, right? Reflection of how Napoleon acted, context, function, structure, process. And then we just never did that iteration. And without those iterations, we were never able to extract, like, what was true of what was happening and what was just variables within the system at the time.
I think one of the challenges that we face as modern militaries, we have to drop all of our tools at once, and we're not willing to do it. We want to drop just one tool. And so that's why when we make changes in doctrine, we're always incremental and evolutionary. New ideas generally don't upset the apple cart, because if you were to do that, say you were to get rid of COGS out of the new FM50, well, then what would you do in all of your other doctrine? My goodness, it would just fall like dominoes. So we end up just changing things, just little bitty, bitty, bitty changes that still maintain what is a Newtonian construct. And the challenge there is that we really have to drop all the tools above the tactical level. So I'm talking operations and strategy and organizations and the social construction of reality, sociology, these things. But particularly in all domain warfare, where we're truly operating with effects in cyberspace, in human minds, and in the social zeitgeist, if you will, of different societies. When we're talking about political warfare, regular warfare, all these things. We have to dismantle all the Newtonian tools so that we can replace them with something else, which I would offer. Systems thinking is very useful. I would offer that I think if we started over with war and complexity science, and we got a bunch of actual complexity science people with with military people, and we said, look, we're going to start from scratch here, and we got to do some experimentation, prototyping, we'd be able to really probably come up with some new military methodologies that would be quite unlike the things that are straitjacketing us right now. And Russell Aikoff said that, you know, a lot of corporate strategic planning is like rain dance. It looks good, everyone feels good, and then if the weather changes, we can be like, look, aha, the strategic planning works, it's proven. And it's like, nah, it's just a coincidence. It's ascientific. So emergence is a really important thing here. Our doctrine, our constructs in Clausewitz didn't know what emergence was, right? And if we try to retcon Clausewitz, and everyone loves doing that. I read articles about how he understood quantum. He meant complexity. He was a chaotician. It's like, no, none of that stuff's real. That's just people trying to extend the legacy into today, and they stretch it like silly putty. So emergence is the change that cannot be understood or even articulated by the causes that don't exist. So it seems like something that occurs without a cause or a clear cause. And additionally, an emergence at a high level, strong emergence, it's going to change the system in profound ways. So the origin of organic life on Earth was one of the highest forms of emergence, right? When you go from inorganic to organic life, when you went to sentient life, or when you went from humans, the arguments are 50 to 60,000 years ago. They think maybe that's when somehow there's a mutation or something where you suddenly had this explosion in brain activity. And that's where you just suddenly had the rise of civilization about, 10,000 years ago. All right, that's level four emergence. Gutenberg's printing press changed the world. That would be strong emergence. The rise of artificial intelligence today is going to be that. And it's going to be that with war. And we're not prepared for it because we want artificial intelligence to be just like all the mechanical tools that we've had in war throughout history. The human is the user. The human controls it. The AI works for the human. The human is part of the decision-making loop, human-machine teaming. We're not prepared to talk about machine-human teaming or machine teaming. And so these are some of the challenges. The last thing I'll throw at you is, looking at levels of war, I'll pick on that for a second because it's closely related in the Jenga pile of our Napoleonic warframe at the very bottom. If you pull it, the whole tower falls. Everything that happens in their tactical level is exactly what happens at the operational, which is exactly what happens at the strategic. It's just scale and scope. So basically, you have ends, ways, and means. You have people that can, at the tactical level, do a series of activities that achieve short-term goals that cumulatively will tie to a measure of performance or effectiveness that's linked to a critical vulnerability that's at the operational level. So this whole thing is stacked like a hierarchy where everything happens at each plane in a way that's linear causal at a phased relationship. And so the problem there is that's not how complexity science operates. That's not how complex reality is. And I'll give you an example. If you have a soldier in World War I who gets, unfortunately, bayoneted in the trenches, that soldier dies. At the tactical level, yes, that platoon is affected, maybe that company. At the much broader scale, one fatality in a battle where 10,000 are dying, such as Verdun, doesn't really matter. Now let's go down into different planes of existence. If you go down to the molecular level, the atomic composition of the soldier versus the soil he's decomposing into, if they don't find him, they don't care. I mean, we assign these values at the social construction layer, which is very important. And this is above physical reality. And this is where we look at kittens and say that they're cute. And we look at snakes and say, ew, yuck, I don't like snakes, right? But when a cat, when a kitten right there, Dan's got one in his hands, ironically. So when a kitten is being swallowed by a boa constrictor, I know, I'm going there. Just stay with me here. Centers of gravity. When a kitten's being swallowed by a boa constrictor, we at the social construction level reality, we all have horrible reactions. Like, oh my God, this is horrible. At the cat and the predator-prey level, not so much. But what I want to do is go down into the molecular level or the organ level. The snake's digestive system does not care how cute a kitten is. It's irrelevant, right? Doesn't matter. And at the molecular level, think about it. The atoms of the kitten and the atoms of the snake doesn't matter. Truly doesn't matter at that level of reality. And that we're not even going into quantum. So let's bring it back to artificial intelligence and centers of gravity. All right. We are constructing these things from a human-centered point of view. What happens if artificial intelligence, right now it's narrow and everyone's freaking out about chatbot, but that's narrow AI, which means it does one thing really, really good. And in this case, it runs through billions of bits of data all over the web, and it correlates patterns that we can't even understand to then create semi-interesting sentences to respond to queries from humans, which are mostly silly. But general AI, which doesn't exist yet, but is theoretical and maybe closer than we think, that is an AI system that can do every single thing faster and better than you. So it's not a Turing test on whether or not it can pass for human. It outperforms the human in every possible way that human could possibly test it. which is scary. Because as soon as you hit general AI that's equal to humans, we probably won't know when it's smarter than us. And it'll probably not want us to know, for good or for bad. And good and bad go out the window because those are human values. So if artificial intelligence at a general level achieves superhuman capabilities of intellect, will we, in the human-machine dynamic, become something more like Dan's cat that he's holding in his arms right now? You can't see this in the podcast, but Dan's sitting there with a nice cat. Cat loves him. But if Dan leaves the room, the cat doesn't know where Dan went and doesn't understand it. You've all probably worked with military working dogs in war. The dogs are great. They do exactly what they're trained to do. But the dog doesn't know a damn thing about the mission statement or the commander's intent. They don't know what the center of gravity is. They don't have the cognitive capacity for it. So we as humans have controlled war all the way since, ever since we created it ourselves out of our own minds. Because there is no nature of war. We created it, right? We didn't create gravity, though. But if an artificial intelligence can understand war in a different way, will it use centers of gravity? Probably not. It'll probably use something else. Maybe something beyond our comprehension. So then the only question becomes, you know, is AI going to look at us as Dan looks at his cat, cares about it, loves it, enjoys it, takes care of it? We could be in an invisible prison in the future in our next wars. So I'm kind of going off the deep end there, but let's bring it back to any last questions, because I know we're a little bit over on time here. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I'm compelled now to go rewatch The Animatrix to determine if the machines did in fact determine that there was a cog within the human opponent system. And one, I mean, I'm just spitballing right now that they probably did.
Oh, well, they did in the movies. And that's actually what Baudrillard, who wrote Simulacra, he hated the Matrix movies. They had all the actors read it and they wrote the script on it. Well, you've noticed Neo's a center of gravity. So the sentient machines are always trying to destroy Neo. You're the one. And Morpheus, they were trying to take Morpheus out. Morpheus is like a critical requirement to Neo, right? And so is Trinity.
Trinity is a critical requirement. Morpheus is a critical vulnerability.
Wait a minute. Is it the other way around? Is Trinity the vulnerability? Because in the end of the third movie, he's sacrificing himself to save her. I don't know.
More peanut butter in my mouth now. So for the audience, if you feel yourself having a similar sensation as I do, where the peanut butter is not actually in your mouth, it's in your brain, just pour some milk over your brain cells. It's going to wash right off. And then listen again at a slower speed, and then we'll get there together.
I would like to point out, Neo didn't matter, right? Neo didn't matter, because that iteration of Neo, if he didn't win, right, it would just happen again. Him as an entity was a singularity, but it happened over and over again. Remember, he's in the room and he sees all the different versions of himself?
Yeah. That's where they kind of lost me, because they went all multiverse. And I love Rick and Morty, but I think that stuff kind of, it throws cogs and everything else out the window. But I would offer this as a public service announcement. If you happen to be in the United States military and you enjoy this type of stuff, feel free to consider applying to an advanced military studies program near you.
Absolutely. Sir, no, we're gonna close out. I'll give you an opportunity. Do you have any closing words of wisdom, maybe some cognitive milk to wash all that down with?
No, what I'd rather do is what everyone else does on social media and do shameless plugging, right? But seriously, I've got two books coming out, and I didn't mean to do that. So this is a great example of emergence. My first book is based off of my doctoral studies, and it's really looking at the whole military design movement worldwide and what it means, where it came from, civilian design, all these different things, right? And what different countries are doing. A big chapter on the Army, which I hope SAMs will either enjoy or ban from their premises. It'll be one of the two. And that's coming out through Routledge, and you can pre-order it on May 19th, and it ships. Physical copies ship on June 9th. But the other book, which is the free one, that one's coming out through Air University Press. That'll be out sometime this summer. And that one's on how would we take design and apply it towards changing planning, which has been a lot of what we discussed. So I know we didn't get to some of the questions on Mobius strips and Klein bottles and inverting a lot of the geometric constructs, right? So that's all in there. So we can do a future podcast and we can meet there. I've got two articles coming out in the United States Marine Corps next issue of their Journal of Advanced Military Studies, or JAMS. That's also free online. Look for it. And these two articles are on artificial intelligence and how war itself may be completely shattered. And I teased a little bit of it at the end, but we're talking in those two articles about the insignificance of future humans or organic regular humans in future battlefields. And then also the rise of singletons, which is a super empowered AI intelligence, and that we could, instead of have nuclear arms race where you're trying to build a nuclear weapon, but you still control it. You're the human decision maker. Well, when you build a singleton, you're creating a means to an end that creates its own new end that you don't control. It creates its own end. It'll be like creating a nuclear bomb that can think for itself and do what it wants. And that's absolutely terrifying. So I know this sounds doomsday-ish. Don't worry, the article balances it nicely. Our robot overlords are not just here yet. But these are explorations into what should we be thinking about 15, 20 years down the road that we need to start really considering in PME, professional military education, now so that we can quickly change some of our doctrine, some of our theory, some of our models before it's too late. Because just don't forget, the United States Army was advocating horse cavalry charges as late as 1938. And the great General Patton in 1930 wrote two articles in Cavalry Magazine arguing that the proper horse cavalryman with his rifle and saber could defeat a tank and could do better reconnaissance than an airplane. Now, luckily, Major Patton then recovered from these mistakes. But this goes back into, are you thinking divergently? Are you curious? Are you creative? Or are you convergent and reinforcing the institutional belief system at the expense of all things that feel uncomfortable? So in the words of Max Planck, the field of theoretical physics advances one funeral at a time. And I think in the next 15 to 20 years, our military is going to have a lot of funerals, conceptually. But the generation that is are probably lieutenants right now, privates, this is all going to be different. And I would hopefully say that COGS may not be gone, but they should have a lot of other things operating that challenge them.
As an editor's note, Dr. Dwibbleson's book, Understanding the Military Design Movement, is currently available for purchase online. Through the month of July, use code SMA35 to get 20% off hardcover and digital purchases of the book. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by checking us out on Twitter at @US_SAMS. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or otherwise would like to engage with us, feel free to email us at operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.